This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is Episode 79, Blaze Spurl, Part 2. Last week, I told you the story of a beautiful, blonde, blue-eyed boy who didn't live to see his second birthday thanks to the drunken rage of his mother's boyfriend. I also told you the story of a mother who reportedly continues to make terrible decisions in regard to her children's safety, even after losing one of them in such a predictable, preventable way. This week, you'll hear my conversation with Berkeley County Deputy Solicitor Anne M. Williams, who prosecuted Justin Hillerby for the murder of Blaze Preston Spurl and has never forgotten the little blonde boy for whom she sought justice. This is part two of the heartbreaking story of Blaze Spurl. Before we get into my conversation with Ms. Williams, I'd first like to thank my newest patrons, Mindy from Lehigh Acres, Florida, and Nikki from Lee's Summit, Missouri. Thank you both so much for your pledges. Every pledge brings me closer to my goal, and I'm truly thankful to every last one of my patrons. I'm a little behind on my Patreon-exclusive bonus minisodes, so I'll be working to get one up within the next week or so. One more thing before we begin as well. I'd like to make a correction to a detail I gave in last week's episode. I mistakenly stated that the incident in which Jennifer Spurl left her infant son in the car at the Ridgeville Roadhouse for 2 to 3 hours took place in November of 2020, but that wasn't quite accurate. November was when DSS received the first report about Jen frequently bringing the baby into the bar. She wasn't reported for leaving the baby in her vehicle until January of 2021. I want to make sure to clear that up because, like I said last week, my allegiance is to the kids in these stories, and it's extremely important to me to be as truthful and accurate as possible in telling their stories. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Prosecutor Anne M. Williams. Today on the podcast, my guest is Anne M. Williams, Berkeley County Deputy Solicitor, who prosecuted the case against Justin Hillerby. Thank you so much for joining me, Ms. Williams.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate all the hard work you put in getting Justin put behind bars where he belongs.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you give us a little info on your background?
Sure. So I started practicing law in the state of Arkansas. I'm one of those people that went back to school after my children were born. So I finished law school at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Started and then got pregnant with my second child and finished after she was born and went right into prosecution. I had clerked at the prosecutor's office in Little Rock and just had a passion for it. Kept thinking I would do it for a few years and get some trial experience and then leave and go make money in a big civil firm, but I never could leave. I just loved it. And I started off with child cases. So that was sort of a blessing and a curse because they're so emotionally taxing, but at the same time, they're so meaningful and you really feel like you're making a difference. So I practiced in Arkansas for 10 years. And then my parents had moved here to South Carolina, where we live outside the Charleston area. And we would come visit and just kind of fell in love with this area. So I retook the bar, which was horrible. But I redid that in 2007 and got a job at the solicitor's office here in the Ninth Circuit, which encompasses Charleston and Berkeley County. And so I immediately began practicing here in our vulnerable victims unit, which is elder abuse, child sexual assault, child physical abuse, And again, sort of continued in that same vein of those cases that are emotionally taxing, but so rewarding when you get the results, like the results we got in the Hillerby case. I have since been promoted to deputy in the Berkeley office. I had gone back to our Charleston office for a short time, a couple of years, and I'm back in the Berkeley office where I prosecuted the Hillerby case, which is the smaller of the two offices in our circuit, a little bit more rural, but growing very quickly. So I'm one of those few people in the world that can say I just love my job.
That's amazing.
Fortunate.
It sounds like it must be very difficult to leave your work at work.
Yes.
So as far as Blaze, he was only 22 months, but what did you find out about him through the process?
So where we found out the most about Blaze was through his grandparents, Leonard and Sharon Spurl, who were just in love with this child. He had a sister, an older sister that they took care of, and they took care of Blaze. And when Leonard would talk about Blaze, you know, his face would light up. He was just so enamored with this child. And he was just a kid that was kind of goofy and kept the family entertained. And he was always over at their house. I think when he wasn't at their house, Leonard or Sharon would go over and make breakfast for the kids, get Serena off to school. That was the older sister. And then take care of Blaze, because the mother, who was their daughter, Jennifer, definitely had some issues and was always battling either a court issue, a transportation issue, an employment issue. And so they were sort of the backbone of that family and the steady, consistent presence for those kids.
I'm glad they had their grandparents. They really did seem like very loving grandparents and parents. I mean, to be there the way they were. I know Jennifer moved to South Carolina with them because she did not have a driver's license for some time. But yeah, they definitely did seem like great grandparents and very responsive. Plus, they lived 3 to 4 blocks away, so that was helpful too.
Right.
Had you prosecuted any child abuse homicides prior to Blaze?
We did. We had a couple of other cases involving real small babies, what used to be called shaken baby syndrome. The language has kind of evolved in that area of medicine and law. But basically, couples that had children that died, and then when they brought them to the hospital, we later found out that they had brain injuries. And that was one of the most interesting things about Blaze's case is that, you know, even though Blaze had some very visible injuries on his face and neck, the real damage and the real tragedy was that there was so much brain damage, and that's what caused him to pass away. And so some of my earlier cases gave me a little bit of a prelude to those kinds of injuries. So we very early got with the pathologist and got a good understanding of what the injuries were, how we could present them to a jury, how they could understand some of the symptoms that Justin himself was describing to law enforcement that he thought were fairly innocuous. But when we got with our experts, our medical experts, they were specifically the kinds of things that would happen after a brain injury. So that became very compelling evidence for us at trial.
That must have been with him sitting in the high chair and not having muscle control and things like that.
Right.
It sounds like he cooked his own goose, so to speak, in that
right.
way.
Right, unknowingly.
Exactly. That's good. I'm glad he wasn't more clever than he turned out to be.
Yeah.
Did you prosecute the case right from the beginning?
I did. We had a really great attorney named Dori Biagianti, who was in our office at the time. And I was the lead prosecutor, but she sat with me on the case and she was great. And we both just jumped right into the case because it was so tragic and so sad. It was nice to have a partner that cared as much about this family and this case as much as I did.
Was there a lot of evidence or discovery in this case?
There was. So we went out to the scene several times. And a lot of the evidence in this case, I mean, there's no smoking gun, so to speak, but a lot of it was witness testimony about working backwards from what Justin told law enforcement to looking at the scene and sort of corroborating the things that he said. So it wasn't like a case where you have like a lot of shell casings or a lot of DNA or, you know, the knife or the gun or those kinds of pieces of physical evidence. But what we did have were eyewitness accounts that were just really compelling. So testimonial evidence. And I have to say, from the very beginning, some of the most compelling evidence came from people that really were not involved in this family, with this family. So earlier in the day, Jen, the mother of the child, and Justin had taken her two children, Serena and Blaze, to the pool. And while they were playing in the pool, there were some teenagers there that were really struck by the way that Justin was treating this child. They were just very disturbed by it. He was talking to him in a really disrespectful and abusive way, calling him names because the child was afraid to get in the water. And remember, this child was 22 months old. Mm-hmm. And it just really struck them, so that when there was some publicity about the child's death, they came forward and were explaining to us what happened. And that was really compelling evidence because they didn't really have a dog in the fight. You know, they were just people that were getting on with their day. They happened to be at the pool that day. And, you know, there were other people that they had told at the time, before anything happened to Blaze, about this incident because it was so disturbing to them. So that was very compelling evidence. There were some roommates that had come home while Justin was babysitting Blaze and had seen Blaze in the corner crying. That was very compelling evidence. And then I think the first responders, both the 911 call and then the first responders' observations about Justin's demeanor, you know, there's never really the right way to respond to tragedy. So we try to educate our juries about, you know, just because someone reacts a particular way to a tragedy doesn't necessarily mean they're guilty or innocent or whatever. But in this case, he was so disengaged. And his 911 call was very flat and very matter of fact. And at the scene, you had Leonard and Sharon, who were the grandparents, completely undone on the front lawn. Jen, the mother, was hysterical. She was crying. And then Justin was just sort of very self-involved and detached and just didn't seem to care. You know, it wasn't like he was in shock. He was just very like, let's get on with it. You know, I've got stuff to do. And that was very compelling evidence. Yeah, and then, of course, the medical evidence was very compelling. You know, having a doctor go through all of the findings about the head injury and talk about the bruises on this child. Not to get overboard with that, but there was a couple of things that really struck jurors, because we had some jurors talk to us after the trial was over. And one of them was, there are certain telltale injuries for child abuse victims. And one of those is bruising inside the ears. And that's because a child can get bruised all different kinds of ways, especially if they're ambulatory. Like if they're walking around, as you can imagine, their heads are a little bit bigger than their bodies. You know, they're at a weird growth point and they can tip over, they can bump into things. But there's no natural way for a child to get a bruise inside his ear. Those are just telltale bruises for child abuse. And it's usually from someone either yanking the child's ears, picking them up by the ears, or doing something that is an inflicted injury. And so things like that were just fascinating to the jury and just sort of layered the different pieces of evidence with the eyewitness accounts. And I thought that was the most compelling thing about the case.
What was your first impression of the case when you first had it come across your desk? What did you think right off the bat?
So at first, we were obviously just horrified by the age of the victim and the number of contusions and bruises and injuries on him. But at the time, there was this strange story that was being floated by the mother of the child and Justin, that this child had died by, I forget what they call it, but it's some kind, it's like a drowning injury. So it's like a dry drowning, like where a child goes into the water and seems fine. And then later in the day, dies from water inhalation.
Right.
And there had been another case in our jurisdiction where that had happened, and it was tragic and it was accidental. And so they sort of latched on to this idea that that must have been what happened, because there's, you know, no other explanation. Right. So we sort of went down that rabbit hole and looking at it. And it wasn't too long after that that we met with the medical professionals, and they just, you know, they put that to rest. They were like, no, this is classic blunt force trauma. This is a brain injury. It wasn't a dry drowning. So that was kind of interesting to us that we had actually taken the bait and gone down that rabbit hole, because that's what they were saying. And I think one of the reasons why is because Leonard and Sharon were so hopeful that it was something like that. I mean, I think it was just maybe easier for them to deal with this if it was an accident. You know, just knowing that it was an abusive infliction of all these injuries was so much for them to bear. But after that, it was really just a very straightforward child abuse case with lots and lots of evidence.
Was there any evidence of prior abuse to Blaze before that day?
So the only people, and this is the problem with child abuse cases, the only people we would ever have that information from would be Blaze, who's gone, or Jen and Justin. And so the mother, Jen, was in total denial about the way that Justin treated her child. Otherwise, after what happened at the pool, she would have never left the child with him. And the Spurls really, they didn't like Justin, but they never witnessed any abuse. What we did have was the fact that he had his own child, and the mother of that child had in the past reported some abuse, minor abuse, you know, heavy spanking, maybe out of proportion discipline to that child, who I believe was not too much older than Blaze. And so she had said that Justin was abusive to that child, both verbally and physically. So we did have that. And ironically, we would have never gotten that evidence in had she not taken the stand in defense of Justin. So the defense called her, and she got up there to try to talk about what a great guy he was, inexplicably.
Right.
And then we were able to impeach her with all the evidence of prior information she had given about how abusive he was to his own child.
Do you know how long Brandy and Eric had lived with the family?
So she had them come in because she needed help paying the mortgage. And I want to say that they had been in the home for just a few months beforehand.
Okay.
And they were not a big fan of Justin either. And although they hadn't witnessed the kind of verbal abuse that the kids at the pool had witnessed, they just never thought that he was very nice to Blaze.
How long did Justin actually live there? I think they moved into that house late 2005.
Yeah, my memory, and I could be wrong with this, but my memory is that Justin and Jen had not even dated that long. He had been in the house not very long before the incident with Blaze. And he was still actually cheating on her with Melissa. That kind of came out later.
Do you think that anyone else was involved besides Justin? Or I know he brought up a third party theory at some point, maybe during his appeal, I think it was. But do you think anyone else was involved, or was he?
No one else was involved. There was a suggestion pre-trial that maybe one of the roommates that we just discussed, Brandy and her boyfriend, were somehow involved. But we filed a motion to exclude that evidence. And the way the law works, you can't, at least in South Carolina and in a lot of jurisdictions, you can't just throw in a concept which we call third-party guilt just to sort of confuse the jury. There has to be some evidence of a connection of that third party that you're suggesting committed the crime, some connection between that third party and the crime scene or the crime. And in this case, there was just no evidence that the roommates had done anything to Blaze. And they were not able to establish any evidence. So the judge excluded the suggestion of them being pointed at as the third party that could have committed this crime. Justin himself admits that he was the only one with the child all night. And in his own words, which were so damning, he gave an evolving statement over a period of time where he began by saying nothing happened. And then he started describing some of the symptoms of head injuries, as we discussed earlier. And then when he found out that it was a blunt force trauma injury, he started coming up with absurd explanations for that. Like maybe he was carrying the child to his crib and accidentally hit Blaze's head on the door frame. Maybe he had hit Blaze's head on the crib when he was placing him in the crib to go to sleep. And so, you know, Justin himself sort of precluded anyone else being involved in the crime by his own words.
And saying he had put him in timeout for spilling his beer and had hit him in the head with his knee or something like that as well.
Right.
So there was no smoking gun, but it was just all of the small pieces put together really built a very solid case.
Exactly. Exactly.
Do you know if there were any DSS cases prior to, I know Serena was removed temporarily at the time Blaze died, but were there any cases before that?
I am not aware of any DSS cases that I can call to mind right now against Jen. I know that there was a parallel DSS case during the whole time that we were trying the case, which was a really big complication for us because DSS was moving the case a lot quicker than we were moving our criminal case. And we were afraid that the older child, Serena, would be given back to Jen. At the time, we didn't know whether she had witnessed anything and would be able to testify. We also needed Jen to testify because there were several jail calls that Justin made to her that were very damning. And so we were sort of in a weird position with that whole family dynamic in trying to keep her on board in cooperating against Justin, trying to placate the grandparents and protect Serena, and also protect the integrity of our own case. So I know that there was a parallel DSS case at the time the criminal case was going on, which created a lot of complications. But I can't remember if there was a DSS case prior to that. I don't think so.
Do you know when Serena was returned?
So it was a good month before she was able to go back to Leonard and Sharon, even because they had to go through a lot of training for foster care home, a certified foster care home and the like. And then she eventually was returned to Jen, I want to say a couple months after the verdict.
Did Leonard or Sharon or Justin's mom, Vicky, testify?
Leonard testified. Okay. Sharon did not. And Leonard was a very compelling witness because he, as I described earlier, was one of the first people at the home when the first responders were there. And his pain was so palpable when he testified. And when he talked about that child, I think it did a lot to bring the jury into that family and to have them understand a little bit more about Blaze. You know, when we go through testimony, sometimes it gets very technical and very objective. And we have to talk about what happened in such clinical terms that any witness that can bring the jury back to the human aspect of this case was so valuable. And Leonard was just such an emotional and compelling witness for us.
So Melissa testified. What about Serena? Did she end up getting on the stand?
No, Serena did not testify. She really didn't have a lot of information. She had what we call a forensic interview with a professional that is trained in different ways to interview children without being suggestive. And she really didn't have enough to offer for us to put her through that experience. She had been through enough, losing her brother, being uprooted, and just the whole thing, that we just didn't feel like that was a good idea.
Did Justin testify on his own behalf?
He did.
Okay.
Again, inexplicably, he testified about a variety of things and just blatantly lied. At one point, he said, so he had gone into law enforcement at one point for a polygraph. And then part of the way through, he decided he didn't want to take the polygraph. Ordinarily, polygraph examinations, the suggestion of them, the fact that one was offered, denied, accepted, are not admissible in court. But Justin got up and said that he passed it, you know, opened the door to us being able to say that that wasn't true and that he actually backed out of the polygraph. And he just rambled on and lied and lied and lied. about various things. And it was very strange because you could tell that that might not have been the strategy that his attorney would have pursued. But whether or not you testify or don't testify as a defendant is one of the decisions that the court specifically asks the defendant. So regardless of what the defense attorney's decision is, the defendant is asked directly from the court in South Carolina whether or not he wants to testify, because it is a constitutional right. He made the decision to testify, and I don't think he did himself any favors.
Do you think if Jennifer had checked on Blaze, was there any medical opinion on this? If she had checked on him when she got home that night, if he would have survived?
I mean, none of us know for sure. But some of the interventions that would have had to have been done for Blaze, according to the medical experts we spoke with, would have had to have been done fairly soon, because the brain was swelling and his brain was so damaged that the way the doctor described it to us, that it wasn't able to send messages to the other parts of his body. And that's why he had pretty significant brain injury. And I don't know the answer to that. I would lean toward no, but it's an impossible question to answer. I know that the pathologist talked about subdural subarachnoid bleeding pretty extensively for Blaze, and also talked about the injury being almost like I don't know if you remember the actress Natasha Richardson getting into a skiing accident and dying later. He said it was a little bit like that, and that's why Blaze was able to sort of stumble around and try to eat in his high chair, that he had probably already had the injury pretty early in the evening, and it just became aggravated and aggravated by Justin's continuous abuse of the child. So by the time he put him in the crib, this child was injured pretty extensively. And that was what the doctor thought, just based on some of the history that was given by Justin and the behavior that he was describing of the child during the evening.
What did he say in his statements to Jen in the jail phone calls that was particularly incriminating?
So several of the things he said were, she was talking about how the police were asking her, you know, if she did anything to the child. And he would say things like, well, you didn't do anything. And then he also apologized extensively to her. I'm so sorry. If you just take me back, you know, nothing like this will ever happen again. He went through the story again about how he must have knocked his head on the door frame and contradicted himself a few times. At one point, he tells law enforcement that somehow he kicked the child or kneed him, and then when he wouldn't get up, he was telling him, get up, walk it off, walk it off. And I think he repeated part of that to her. And so it was just another layer of explanations and stories about what happened that evening, that some were very damning and some were damning because they contradicted earlier versions of it.
Did you have a theory on what actually happened, or was it just basically piecing together his statements and trying to sift through what may or may not have been true there?
Both. I think what happened was they got into an argument about whose turn it was to watch Blaze, and she wanted to go out for the evening, and so did he. So he started out the night resentful about having to watch the child. And then I do think probably Blaze knocked over his beer, because he kept saying that over and over again in each version. And he just lost his temper and blew up at the child and just beat him. I just think he got really angry and beat him. And I think at one point the child hit his head on the floor, because that's described in one of the versions. And then he decided he would try to feed him and put him in the crib. And I think he was so self-involved and so oblivious that he didn't even realize how bad it was until the next day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whether it was intentional or not, it was, you know, the actions were inflicted. They were intentional. So I'm glad that he did get a life sentence where it could have been a lot less. Some states don't punish child abuse homicides as strongly as they do regular homicides, let's say.
We were very grateful for the judge seeing this case for what it was. And, you know, there are no more vulnerable victims than children, and there is no more heinous act. So, you know, the fact that she saw the case early on for what it was and dealt out a punishment that was appropriate for Hillerby's actions was very, very, it was a relief for us. They're very difficult cases to prove because a lot of times, especially with really, really small kids, the only people around are the people that are taking care of the child and the child, him or herself. It's not like a situation where there's a bunch of adults out and something happens and there's a shooting or a stabbing or something like that. These usually happen in the child's home. And so the evidence and the testimony become the medical evidence of the child. And then it becomes a real problem in figuring out who did it. Like many times in child abuse cases, there's overwhelming evidence that the wounds are inflicted and that it's a purposeful killing, that it's not just an accident. But the difficulty is who did it. And in this case, we were very, very fortunate in that Jen was out and he was home. And by his own version of events, he was the only person with the child. So that was very, very helpful. Had they both been home and pointed the finger at each other, it would have been harder to prove which one of them inflicted the injuries.
I bet, yeah. Now, I know Jen was charged initially with one count of neglect, but that was ultimately dropped or nullprost, as you said. Can you talk about why that charge wasn't pursued?
Sure. She had that charge pending throughout the trial, and that charge is what we call in South Carolina a nonviolent charge. That doesn't mean it's not violent all the time. It means that statutorily it's not violent. So whereas some charges you have to serve 85% of your sentence, unlawful conduct towards a child, you would probably serve maybe a third, depending on what happens at the Department of Corrections. She was charged with that. It carried 0 to 10 years. She also had this DSS case that was going on. And it looked like DSS was going to close their case and give the child back to her. Leonard and Sharon were afraid that that shouldn't be, give the other child back to her. Let me clarify that, Serena. They were afraid that that was going to be too soon. So we wound up making a global decision based on all the factors and saying, if you agree that DSS case will remain open, in other words, that the custody of Serena will remain with Leonard and Sharon for longer, that you will wait to get your child back, that you have to go through certain classes to get your child back, then we will drop the criminal case. And we were getting a little bit of pressure from Leonard and Sharon about, hey, the criminal case is going to end. And even if she goes to jail, she's going to serve 3 years, which they didn't want to happen. Most likely a judge wouldn't give her jail time. But then what happens to our family afterwards? You know, what happens to Serena afterwards? So we sort of made a global decision that we would agree to let the criminal case go if we could accomplish some things with classes for Jen so that she could get some parenting classes, some alcohol classes with regard to her being better prepared to parent Serena later than, you know, whatever we were going to get from the criminal case. And she had also cooperated all the way through, which you wouldn't think would be a big deal, like any mother should. But there were times when we were concerned that she wasn't going to cooperate in the very beginning, especially because she was still kind of enamored with Justin, you know, which made no sense, but that's where we were and we really needed her cooperation. So we made that difficult decision to let the criminal charge go on Jen and to see what would happen with that family and hope that she would get the help she needed so that whenever she got Serena back, she would be a better mother.
I think that's a very fair and thorough answer. You know, I know a lot of people are going to wonder about that particular charge, and a lot of people are out for blood when it comes to cases like this, but that really does make sense. As far as the appeal, did you handle the state side of things all the way through Justin's appeal?
We did not. The Attorney General's Office for our state handles all appeals. And there was actually, there's two levels of that, of the post-trial legal maneuverings. One is basically what we call it as a PCR. Mm-hmm. And in that, the defendant is claiming that he did not get adequate representation. So he's basically attacking his own attorney and trying to get the case turned over based on whether or not that attorney did a good enough job. The mm-hmm. other appeal is all of the appellate work that is done by our Attorney General's office, which is truly an argument about the mechanics of the case, whether things were done properly procedurally from an evidentiary standpoint, whether evidence was let in that shouldn't have been let in, and those kinds of things.
And both appeals were denied. And does he have further appeals, or is that pretty much it?
He does not. He may have what we call a habeas corpus action, which is essentially saying it's under the Eighth Amendment, which says that to continue to incarcerate him would be cruel and unusual punishment. And those cases are pretty rare. And so I don't, you know, in my opinion, he's not going to be successful there. And after that, the only thing left would be a pardon from the governor. And one would hope that of all the cases in the universe, this would not be the kind of case that any governor would excuse somebody for.
I sure hope not. Now, I was curious if you had any thoughts on Dr. Michael Bodden's testimony during those hearings. It was just, I was kind of surprised to see that he had the opinions he had.
I know. I was really shocked by that. I attended that hearing, and I don't think they called on me to testify. But my only experience with that expert was through the O.J. Simpson case. Mm-hmm. And watching him on that platform, I thought, wow, you know, he really knows his stuff. And whether you agreed or didn't agree with what happened in the O.J. Simpson case, he certainly seemed competent, and his level of expertise was admired by so many people who were commenting on the case on television. But his testimony in the Hillary case was so absurd. Mm-hmm. It was almost like, I think at one point he said the bruises inside the child's ear clearly had to come from Serena because right. they were so small that only another child's fingers could fit in there. Or it could be like a pencil eraser or something like that, which that in of itself is absurd. I talked to a lot of child abuse experts after that testimony, and they were like, that's ridiculous. And then in addition, okay, well, even if you could somehow find some explanation for the bruises inside this child's ear, what about the other points of impact? What about all the other stuff? And what about all of the statements made by the defendant himself? And the reason why that's important is because almost every expert that deals with child abuse cases will tell you that some of the most important pieces of information when you look at diagnosis and explanations is history. And what I mean by that is what happened, you know, what did people say happened? You can't just look at the body or the brain or the bruises in a vacuum. You have to kind of gather information from what people say happened to the child to sort of piece it together, or any patient. That's why every single medical diagnosis looks at history. So, you know, that testimony just seemed absurd to me in light of the fact that there was this whole other lot of information and testimony and evidence beyond the bruising inside the ears. So I was kind of disappointed. It sort of deflated my image of him.
Yeah, that's the same. He had an HBO show, and he was involved in the Mary Beth Tinning case, and he's just renowned. And when I found out he was involved in this and had those things to say, it was just kind of a shock, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that at least they kind of struck that down based on the fact that he didn't conduct an autopsy and he didn't read the whole trial testimony. And yeah, I guess he must have had a very limited amount of time and set of evidence to look at.
Right. And the fact that he would opine about that, given the fact that he didn't have very much to look at, is remarkable to me.
It is. Yeah. I guess that's one of the dangers of paying experts for their testimony. It doesn't always come out to be exactly what it should, maybe.
True.
Have you taken anything away from this case? You know, did you learn any particular things from it, or even any similarities, you know, between this and other child abuse cases? What I really try to do is help people to understand what they might be seeing. If you see something, say something, but people don't necessarily know what they're seeing.
Right, right. Well, we do have an awful lot of child abuse cases where brain injuries are a factor. Mm-hmm. And I think that what we have learned is if your child is not acting the way he ordinarily acts, then there's a reason for that. And I think sometimes if you don't know abuse has occurred, like maybe a babysitter or somebody has had the child that you don't suspect, you maybe don't put it all together. So I guess I would just say, you know, better to be safe than sorry. If there are some symptoms that you are witnessing for your child and they're not old enough to explain to you what happened, then don't feel like you're going to overreact by getting medical intervention. You know, check it out. Worst thing that happens is there's nothing wrong and you go home. And just don't leave your children with people that you don't trust. I cannot tell you how many times we hear about situations where a child is left with a new babysitter or a boyfriend or a friend. And, you know, those people don't have an emotional connection to your child. And children can be challenging. You know, young children can really test the patience of people. So, you know, unless they really love your child, they may lose their temper. And so you better know who is going to be watching over your precious child before you leave them with them.
Definitely. You don't want to stereotype mom's boyfriend, but it also does tend to be more often than not an unrelated adult in the home. And you know, it's just scary. You don't know who you can trust, but especially if you haven't known them very long, it just doesn't seem prudent to trust the most precious thing in your life with that person.
Right. Those cases, you just see those children in your head all the time. And sometimes we run into jurors in our community, and those are the ones that stick with them. And those are the people that I feel the sorriest for, because I've chosen this line of work. But to be picked for a jury and to, you know, have a story unfold that's so upsetting and so, so impactful, it's hard for me to imagine what they go through thinking about these children and what they endured.
Seeing the photos can't be easy for anyone, but especially if you don't know what's in store for you, it's got to be traumatic.
Yeah. But they rise to the occasion each time. I'm so proud of our juries, you know, because they do it. You know, they get in there, they take time out of their busy life, and a lot of them don't try to get off the jury and sit through disturbing evidence, and then they render verdicts. And it's really a remarkable part of our system and why it's the best system in the world.
Huge thanks to Ms. Williams for talking with me about Blaze and for her hard work in getting justice for him. That's it for this week. Join me next week for another case. If you like the show, please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. And please subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes and become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter at STLCPod. View photos related to today's case on Facebook and Instagram. Read more about today's case and many others at sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast was written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music. Other music and sound effects for the show were created using sounds from audiojungle.net. Hug your babies a bit closer tonight. Until next week, bye guys.